The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Welcome, welcome. Good evening. Greetings. It's nice to sit together. So this type of practice that we do here at IMC, the Insight Meditation Center, sometimes it's called Vipassana. And there's a few different ways we can translate that term. But one way is clear seeing, which then gets interpreted as insight. Clear seeing. So this kind of got me curious about this whole notion of seeing, which shows up again and again in the suttas in a number of different ways. And there's a different way in which we can understand our practice to be so much about seeing. But even in English, so let's see how my voice does. Even in English, there's different, this word seeing, like, has so many different meanings. The obvious one, right, is just to see something with the eyes, this, a visual object. But we also have this idea of like, oh, if some, there's a romantic relationship. Oh yeah, they've been seeing each other for a few months now. Or maybe there's this way of a salesperson might say, can't you just see yourself in this car or something, right? You know, just like envision or imagine or, you know, something that's just in the mind. Or maybe there's something about understanding or comprehension. It's like, oh, I see. So just like in English, we kind of see this kind of in the Pali and in the way in which insight or seeing gets talked about in the early teachings. So the Buddhist teachings, they have a lot to say about just this very simple act of seeing, but I'm not going to talk too much about that. Just this idea that there's objects out there, there's eyeballs and minds in here, and the two come together and seeing happens. Not too complicated. Well, maybe it is quite complicated, but in some way we could just think of it as something simple. But maybe what's a little bit more interesting is this idea of the roles that our minds have in what we expect to be just a very simple process of just seeing this yellow tape here, for example. But our minds aren't like cameras. They aren't like accurately seeing things and capturing things, even though we often think that they are. We are often believing or thinking that, okay, what we're seeing there is that's just the way that it is. But have you ever noticed that if you ever see a photograph of yourself, you're like, really? Wait, do I look like that? There's a way in which what we see in the mirror doesn't quite match what we see in the photograph. So, Joe, do you know that we can hear what you're doing? Okay, there we go. Or maybe there's this way, I had this experience not too long ago where I was at a beach and found this shell that was really interesting and picked it up and looked at it like, wow, look at this. I wonder what kind of creature this is associated with or something. And then just continued walking on the beach and then boom, wow, those shells were everywhere. And I noticed that they had always been there. I just hadn't seen them. But when I saw the first one, then all of a sudden I can see them more. So this is like a well-established phenomenon, that is, that when we start to see something, then the mind maybe starts to incline towards something that's familiar. And we might even start to think, wow, there's so many of these. But, you know, the number of them, the amount of them hasn't changed at all. We're just starting to notice. Advertisers kind of count on us having this experience. And we often have this idea that, well, I think I'm going to buy a new car. And then all of a sudden, boom, you see there's all these cars you're thinking about buying are the ones that are on the roads with you or something like this. So it's not that those types of cars are just now on the road. You're just now noticing them. So I'm just pointing to this idea that this what the mind sees or what we're actually seeing is selective. And then I will even add to that, and we're adding on top of this interpretations so often. But before I get there, I'd like to say a poem, right? I don't know, I'm in this phase of a lot of poems these days. I'm sure I'll get out of that phase, but this is the poem phase right now. So this is a poem by Rosemary Traumer. And it's called Insight. Insight by Rosemary Traumer. And this poem goes like this. I'm not sure I could say they're beautiful, these brittle brown cinquefoil stems trembling in the wind. Though part of me longs to find beauty everywhere, the longing to see beauty shapes the way I meet the world. There, seeing this truth, beautiful as a golden flower. I'll read this again. I'm not sure I could say they are beautiful, these brittle brown cinquefoil stems trembling in the wind. Though part of me longs to find beauty everywhere. The longing to see beauty shapes the way I meet the world. There, seeing this truth, beautiful as a golden flower. The number of things that are happening in this poem's actually doing a lot of work for us. And I love that she titles it Insight, because first, she's just seeing these cinquefoil stems. These are plants that certain times of the year, they lose their leaves and they're just like sticks sticking in the ground or something. And she's saying, oh, these aren't so beautiful. So this kind of, maybe this disappointment of seeing these stick-like plants. But then she's noticing, oh yeah, I want to see things that are beautiful. We have this preference and we're kind of like looking for things that are aesthetically pleasing and that bring some delight, that are nice to see. Like, why not? And there's something that when we're looking for things that are beautiful, then we start to see things that are not beautiful. We start, there's a little bit of a checklist. Is this beautiful? No. Is this beautiful? Yep. Is that beautiful? Well, it could be beautiful if it just changed this thing over here and move that around there and that, you know. So there's this way we're setting up this evaluation, and we're not so much just meeting things as they are. Instead, we're evaluating, judging, comparing based on some idea that we have in our mind. Going out for a walk, I should see beautiful things, for example. So she's noticing how there's this, maybe this, comparison or this judging that's showing up. And then she's noticing that she noticed. She's saying, oh, there, seeing this truth, beautiful as a golden flower. So just seeing how the mind operates and how it influences what we are seeing with our eyes, recognizing that is beautiful. This greater understanding, the seeing that the mind is not like a camera. Instead, there's seeing that happens with the eyes. And then there's things that get added evaluation, judgment, liking, not liking. So the mind is not neutral. It longs, it fears, it searches, and it leans towards some things in a way towards other things. And this leaning shapes what appears in our visual field. What maybe gets noted in the mind is in the visual field. And understanding the lenses through which we are seeing the world, so helpful. So helpful. And she recognizes this in this poem. Because recognizing some of the lenses that we're using might undermine some of the authority that we are giving to our notions about the world, about way things should be and what's good and what's bad, what's desirable, what's undesirable, these types of things. Because I would say that a big part of mindfulness practice, part of insight practice, is learning to notice what is being seen and what is being added by the mind. What is being seen with the eyes and what's being added by the mind. The longing, the fear, the habit, the hope, all these things that get added by the mind. Of course the mind is doing that. We don't have to make it wrong. The point is that we are taking this like, oh, this is the truth. This is the only way it is. And whether this thing is good or bad or beautiful or not beautiful, somehow inherent in that object. It's not inherent in that object. It's something that the mind is adding. We all know this. Like with food, we might have some food like, oh, Brussels sprout. No, 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 thank you. I actually like Brussels sprouts, but I know that sometimes there can be something that not everybody does. But there's a way in which we might think, yeah, Brussels sprouts, ick. And there's this way we just think they're just inherently icky. But of course they're not, because some people like them. It's true about everything. The ickiness, the desirability, the liking, the not liking is not in the object. It's in the mind. And seeing that and understanding that and seeing that again and again is so helpful. It can be life-changing. It can be transformative. Just to understand this, because our minds make stories based on what they're seeing, and sometimes these stories are helpful and sometimes they're not helpful. For example, if I need to remember to bring something somewhere, when I often will put it like near the door so that when I'm walking out the door, I see it. And the mind makes a story, oh yeah, that's the thing I need to bring. This is helpful. But maybe in the same way, there's a pile of papers on my desk. And then there could just be like, oh, I'm such a slob. My life is a mess. When am I going to get it together? Or what's wrong with me? Why is my desk always messy? I hope nobody sees my messy desk or something like this. Right? There's a way in which we can just see something. It's just papers on a desk. And yet this whole story gets added onto it. And this, if not seen, clearly, we can just start to believe this, that one's life is a mess, or that we are a disaster in some kind of way. And this has an impact on us, this inner dialogue, this way in which we are interpreting what we're seeing with the eyes is like creating the conditions for this big, long story about us. And maybe that story is not one that's helpful. Or maybe we see someone outside that's out for a run, and then maybe there's the mind goes into comparison. And, yeah, I used to run. I should run. Yeah, my life is too busy, or I don't have time anymore. And that just there's this way in which we could just maybe the inner critic gets activated. It's just seeing somebody running. That's all it is. Seeing somebody run could also be like, wow, just the joy of running, just the delight of moving the body is such a beautiful thing. I remember when I used to do that. It's great. Often the inner critic, though, gets activated. So it's not that what we see is the source of suffering, seeing a messy desk, person jogging, food we don't like. It's what the mind does with it. It's what the mind makes it mean. And so part of this practice is to just really help us to see the way that the mind is judging or comparing or evaluating or telling a story. And when we recognize, oh, this is something that's got added on by the mind, it's just a person jogging. It's just a stack of paper. When we can see that, there's definitely some more space. There's room for something different to unfold. Instead of like the usual progression of the mind beating itself up in some kind of way. Maybe instead the attention broadens and the grip loosens, the grip on the story of about oneself being this way or that way, being a messy person, being a lazy person, whatever it might be. But if we can start to see, and we're less entangled in the story, and then the thoughts have less authority. Doesn't mean that the thoughts stop arising. They still arise, but they don't seem like the reality or the truth and the whole truth or something like that. And this is one way freedom begins. Not because what we see is different, but because we begin to see more clearly, including what the mind is adding. So then we might say that there's seeing objects, there's seeing with the mind, what the mind adds, and then we might say there's a seeing through something, because with this practice, when we start to see what the mind is adding and we start to see experiences, we'll see what is there, but we're starting to see the mind meeting the object, and we start to see that, well, maybe I'll use this little example. Let's say that someone speaks sharply. And your experience, and usually the mind moves very quickly and makes an evaluation. Oh, that person is rude. And then there's like this, there's a little maybe a hurtful feeling of hurt, or either for ourselves if the person was speaking to us or for the other person. And then there's all of a sudden a sense of like, okay, this is a problem and it has to be fixed. But with mindfulness, we can start to see, oh, there was hearing that happened. And then there was also like this tightness and this hurt, sense of hurt, and maybe a sense of defensiveness arose. And then there's this urge to respond. Now we're seeing something more, not just what happened, but how the experience is being interpreted as it's a problem and something must be done. And then we often are finding ourselves doing things that are just being out of this reactivity, just being pushed to do something, not even being aware of maybe the push that's there. Because when we're caught in the story, like this is a problem that has to be fixed, and I'm not saying that people speaking sharply is perfectly fine and we should allow people to do whatever they want. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that when we start to see this process, then it opens up the possibility that something else can happen, that there can be a different response. Because when we're caught in the story, we tend to take things as solid. personal, means something about us. And it's the whole truth. Everything is there. But when the process becomes more visible, there's maybe more space, and hurt can be known as hurt, and anger can be known as anger. And the urge to react can be known as the urge to react. And then we're not quite so tangled up in it and bound by it. The pain may still be there. The discomfort of those sharp words may still be there, that they're not going away, but there's less suffering that gets added on top of it. It's just like, ouch, that hurt. And there isn't that immediate wish to retaliate or do something that might be wise and might not be wise. And then we'll start to see something else. We start to see that actually this too is changing. Like the sound is gone of that, those sharp words, and the tightening has shifted, and the hurt is not, isn't being experienced exactly the same. Maybe it's diminished. Maybe it's gotten worse. Maybe it feels less like a tightening, more like a stabbing in the chest or something like this. What seems so solid doesn't seem so solid anymore if we're able to stay with the experience. Whereas before, we're just bouncing off of it. It seems like we don't have a choice but just to react. But maybe we can, with insight, we can start to see, oh yeah, this is a whole process. It's a whole cascade of events. And these events are moving and changing. All of them are. It's not such a one very specific encased experience. It's just things that are flowing and we're responding to them. So maybe what seemed so personal about us just is actually, it can also be seen, it's just part of a process. This person said of this because some of their conditioning, I don't like it because some of my conditioning. It's not like things are extracted from the conditions of the world. It's just happening because all these other things are happening. It couldn't be otherwise, actually. And so what seemed like the whole truth starts to see like, oh, that was just a moment. And now that moment is different. This moment is this moment. So part of practice is learning to notice the difference between what is seen and what is added. At first we notice the object, then we start to notice what the mind is adding, the judgment, the evaluation, the wanting, the resistance, the story making, all this. And sometimes we begin to see that even these are just passing processes also. And this is where something loosens. This is where this sense of it's going to go towards more and more difficulty, it starts to open up to like, oh, there can be more and more freedom here. There can be a sense of things moving differently instead of inevitably towards, because somebody said something sharply that I'm going to be in a bad mood and I'm going to send a curt message to that person back or yell or whatever it might be. So we have difficulties not only from what experiences what experiences arise, but part of the difficulties is because we don't always notice how much the mind is shaping what we're seeing. And when that, the mind shaping that itself becomes visible, there can be less reactivity, less entanglement, and more freedom. When the shaping that the mind does becomes visible, there's less reactivity and more freedom. And that's insight. To see what's being added. To see how things aren't as solid and as we think they are. And with that, I'll close and open it up, see if there's questions or comments. Thank you. Anybody have a question or a comment?
So you look on the world and you see what's really there, or is it always a process of more and more evolution and seeing clearly, more clearly over time?
I don't think humans see things like a camera and never will. I don't think humans ever will. That the right we have filters of some sort that are always operating. And maybe that's part of the beauty of photography, is that things look a little bit different than with the eyes, maybe. Yeah, thank you for that question.
Thank you. I don't exactly know how to phrase this question, but as I was listening to the talk and thinking about the concepts around clear seeing, and I thought so often during meditation the eyes are closed, and that it's kind of like clear hearing. But then also then during a Dharma talk, the mind has to process all of the bits of language that are conveying an idea. And there is so much energy to do that, that you almost need to absorb. And yet a part is also trying to not necessarily judge, but possibly to respond, to say, to refute. And that's a lot going on right there. So I just noticed that challenge of listening clearly.
Nice.
I don't know more what
nice.
To say to that, but just I noticed that.
Nice. Thank you. I heard a Dharma teacher say that, Dharma talks are boring. Don't listen to them. Just sit and let the heart hear. Don't let the mind. The mind, the words are just to entertain the mind, but let the heart feel, or let the heart hear. So just get that whole mind out of the way there. But you can't, right? So, and I kind of appreciated, this was a Dharma teacher, right? Who, before his talk, said, just don't ignore what I'm saying, but just let the heart speak, hear, listen. So maybe that's one way.
Thank you.
I wonder if you can connect the dots a little bit. I mean, I think I understood this implicitly in what you were saying, but, always coming back to the present, because you sort of talked about there is what is seen, and then there's what the mind brings to what is being seen. And it just seemed, what I was thinking was, well, this is why you want the mind to always try to be just in the present moment, because that is what's actually happening.
Thank you. Yes, and I didn't say that explicitly. I'm glad that you brought this in. You're absolutely right, because coming back to the present moment interrupts the momentum of the story making and all the judgments and evaluations. Yeah. It's, thank you. And part of the maybe some of the practice of mindfulness is just to help us to recognize when we're not in the present moment too, right? Just so often we're not there. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so wishing you all a lovely rest of the evening and safe travels home. Thank you.